Oxford University. He received his PhD also from Oxford University. After that, he spent 2 years at Edinburgh University as a postdoc. After that, he was a lecturer in physics at Southampton University for about 8 years. He was awarded a Humboldt Research Prize in 2000 and also Rayleigh Medal. Today, he will tell us about relaxation in driven integer quantum Hall edge states.
Okay, thank you. And thanks very much for giving me the chance to visit. It's the first time I've been here, and I must say it's all extremely impressive. It'll also be the first time I've used a hockey stick as a pointer. So to put what I'm going to talk about today into context, there's a lot of interest at the moment in systems that are far from equilibrium, and that includes problems both on the classical side and on the quantum side. On the quantum side, a lot of the interest comes, of course, from experiments on cold atom systems. And the reason for that is that in that setting, you can often isolate the degrees of freedom that you're interested in and look at coherent quantum time evolution of some interacting system. But it turns out that there are some settings in conventional condensed matter physics where you can do analogous experiments, and it's one of those that I want to talk about today. The work that I'll actually describe is joint with Dmitry Kovrzhin, who is a postdoc in Oxford, and it builds on work which I did in the past, partly with Yuval Geffen and Martin Viet, who was a postdoc in Oxford. So in the first part of the talk, I'll tell you about these experiments, which I think are very nice and, from a theorist perspective, very simple examples of probing a non-equilibrium quantum system. And then I'll tell you about a couple of ways of thinking about this sort of problem theoretically, one involving a kind of toy problem, which I think is quite useful, and the other essentially an exact solution of what I think is the simplest sensible model for the experiment. And as you'll see, the results fit quite a lot of details of the experiment quite well. So I wasn't sure what kind of background I should assume, and maybe this is too simple, but I didn't want to leave people behind. So let me begin really with the basics. And fortunately, Xiaogang Wen isn't here. So I'm going to be talking about quantum Hall edge states. So we'll be thinking about two-dimensional electron gas in a perpendicular magnetic field. And if you think about the dynamics of the electrons just classically to begin with, then of course in the bulk they move in circular orbits, but near the edge of the sample the classical orbits are parts of a circle, arcs of a circle, with reflection when the particle meets the boundary, so that on average you get these skipping orbits which drift around the perimeter of the sample in the opposite sense to the cyclotron motion within the bulk. And of course, we can think about the same problem quantum mechanically, and within the bulk, this cyclotron motion is quantized into a discrete set of Landau levels. And then if we represent the boundary of the sample by some confining potential which changes smoothly on the scale of the magnetic length, then we can think of these Landau levels as being bent up in energy as a function of position. And if we consider states at a certain energy between two Landau levels, then those are states located at the edge of the sample, and the electrons in those states move around the edge of the sample in the same way as in the classical picture. So the central fact that everything else I'll be talking about depends on is that these edge states are really excellent waveguides for electrons. So if we think about this right-hand picture and concentrate on the details in the plane of energy vertically and distance from the edge of the sample horizontally, then we have a sequence of Landau levels, well-defined energies in the bulk, being bent up at the edge of the sample, and then with a chemical potential located between Landau levels, the states at the chemical potential are just at the boundary of the system. And the fact that makes them very good waveguides for electrons is that there are really no states that these electrons can be scattered into, at least in this ideal picture. There are no states in the bulk. And what's more, the electrons at the edge are all going in a given direction. And so the only possible scattering is in the forward direction, perhaps with a phase shift. Now, to actually do interesting experiments with edge states, or to do the kind of experiments I want to talk about, we need one more ingredient, and that's, well, in the optics language, it would be a beam splitter, or in the mesoscopic electron system language, it's a quantum point contact. So imagine here that we've got our sample with edge states moving in one direction at the top and in the opposite direction at the bottom, and we have a couple of electrodes deposited above the electron layer, and by applying potentials, we can squeeze the edge states at the two sides of the sample together so that if they come within of order an electron wavelength of each other, an electron which comes in, say, from the left at the top, has an amplitude to propagate through, but also an amplitude to get scattered back. So the experiment that I want to talk about uses just one of those beam splitters. So we have a couple of quantum Hall edges, this one coming from a source at some chemical potential mu, and this one at the top coming from a source at a chemical potential higher by some voltage V. And they meet at a quantum point contact, and there's some probability for the electrons incident along this top edge to get scattered and leave by the bottom edge, and a complementary probability for them to go straight on. So if we think about what would happen in a setup like this, just in single particle language, we can ask, for instance, what the electron distribution is as a function of energy on this outgoing channel close to the quantum point contact. And if we think about a simple situation where the incoming electrons are from sources at zero temperature, then the electron states will be completely occupied up to the chemical potential of this incident edge, so that would correspond to this energy here, and they'll be completely empty above the higher chemical potential, so this would be mu plus EV, and states in the energy interval in between will be occupied with some partial probability, which is determined by the scattering probability at the point contact. So we can imagine setting up an electron distribution on the edge by the scattering process. And of course, if there weren't any interactions, then that would simply propagate downstream. But if there are interactions, then you can imagine that this electron distribution will relax as a function of distance and reach something maybe like a thermal distribution as we go downstream. And that's the experiment that I'll show you results for in a moment, and which I want to talk about theory for. But before I actually show you the details of the experiment itself, it's maybe worth mentioning a couple of other experiments to put this in context. So of course, one feature of doing this kind of experiment with quantum Hall edges is that the edges are one channel, or if you were at filling factor two or three, two channel or three channel waveguides for the electrons. And another feature is that, of course, the electrons move in one direction, so these edge states are chiral. In fact, an experiment a bit like this was done with non-chiral multi-channel conductors about 15 years ago. So you take a small metal wire between two contacts, and you apply a finite potential difference between these two contacts, and you measure the electron distribution in the wire. And in this experiment, they use tunneling into a piece of superconductor. And the basic point is that because in the superconductor, you have structure and the density of states from the BCS gap. If you look at tunneling as a function of the voltage on the superconductor, you measure the density of states convolved with the BCS density of states, and then you can get the electron density of states in the wire by undoing the convolution. So in this experiment, you can measure the electron distribution as a function of energy in the wire, and in the absence of any bias, you get a Fermi distribution. But as you apply increasing bias, you see an electron distribution with a double step form. So the idea is that these are electrons which diffuse to the place where you're measuring the distribution from one contact, and these are electrons which diffuse from the other contact. So that experiment turned out to be something that you can understand theoretically in quite a lot of detail by using a Boltzmann equation to discuss the scattering of electrons within the wire, but it's really in a different kind of regime from the quantum Hall experiment that I'll be talking about. Carrying on with the theme of trying to put this experiment into context, since I'm talking about tunneling into quantum Hall edge states, it's maybe worth making a contrast with some classic experiments which also involve tunneling into quantum Hall edge states, but in that case, fractional edge states. So, of course, with fractional quantum Hall edge states, you have Luttinger liquid behavior with power law response depending on the precise filling factor. And one way in which that's been probed is by looking at power law dependence of the differential conductance for tunneling into the edge states from a contact. And this theory was developed by Kane and Fisher, and there were classic experiments a few years later. And this picture illustrates that power law dependence on a log-log plot. So the point of showing this in relation to the experiments that I want to focus on is really just to emphasize that whereas this is to do with the fractional quantum Hall effect, the experiments I'll be describing involve integer quantum Hall edge states. Here, what's being probed is the conductance of the point contact itself as a function of bias, which is, of course, something quite different from what I want to talk about, which is the electron distribution on the edge downstream from the point contact. And actually, in the context of an experiment like this, the standard line has been that whereas fractional edges are very interesting because of the correlations of the fractional quantum Hall effect, integer edges are often regarded as boring because it's true that asymptotically at low energies, an integer quantum Hall edge is simply equivalent to a non-interacting chiral Fermi gas in one dimension. Conversely, that means that all the interesting physics in involving integer quantum Hall edges comes about at least partly in these experiments because they're being pushed out of equilibrium, and this extremely simple asymptotic low energy description of the edges as equivalent to non-interacting Fermi gases is breaking down. Of course, if it broke down in some completely non-universal way, we perhaps wouldn't be interested, but as you'll see, I think it breaks down in some reasonably simple ways. So the third experiment, which I wanted to mention, at least in passing, is maybe a rather more fanciful comparison. But as I said at the beginning, a lot of the interest in quantum systems out of equilibrium at the moment is because of experiments in using cold atoms. And one very well-known example is this quantum Newton's cradle, where you take a Bose condensate in a quasi one-dimensional trap and give it a kick to split it into two pieces, which then oscillate backwards and forwards in the trap. And one of the surprises when this experiment was done is that the oscillations seem to be very little damped. And I'm not sure how well understood that is even now, but at least part of the understanding is probably connected to the fact that this cold atom system is close to being integrable. And that's going to be important for the quantum Hall edges that I talk about, because at least in the simplest description there, we turn out to have an integrable model. And so this brings you to some quite basic questions about how relaxation or equilibration can take place in a system that has many degrees of freedom that are many conservation laws. Okay, so that's background, and now let me show you the details of the experiment that I gave you a schematic view of to begin with. So the sample is really very much like the schematic description that I told you about. We have two sources for electrons at different chemical potentials. So we'll be driving the system out of equilibrium by having a bias between these two. And then these two sources meet at this beam splitter, this quantum point contact. And so we generate a non-equilibrium electron distribution in the edge, which then propagates some distance. And we measure what that distribution is by tunneling through a quantum dot, which has a sharply defined energy level. And then you can move the energy of that level up and down using a gate electrode and sweep out the electron distribution in the edge. And the other feature of the experiment that's important, that's not terribly obvious from this picture, is that you can vary the distance between the quantum point contact where you generate the non-equilibrium distribution and the quantum dot where you measure it. And the way that you vary that distance is by using some gates to divert the edge state along different possible paths between the places where you generate the non-equilibrium distribution and where you measure it. Okay, and then what's measured? Well, strictly speaking, it's a spectral function, but if we can think about it in single particle language, then it's simply the energy derivative of the electron distribution as a function of energy. So if I go back to my schematic picture of the experiment, what we're actually looking at experimentally is the derivative of this curve, or the derivative of this one if the energy distribution has equilibrated. And of course, for this curve, I simplified things by drawing how it would be if the two electron sources are at zero temperature. But if there are some low non-zero temperature, then these steps will be slightly rounded. So when I take an energy derivative, I'll have two downward going spikes in this first case. And in the second case, I'll have a single downward going spike, which will be broader because this energy step is broader. And that's, in fact, what the experiment looks like. If you measure the derivative in energy of the electron distribution close to the point contact, you see these two downward going spikes showing that we've got a double step distribution. And if you look at how that evolves with distance from the point contact, then at long distances, you get to a single step distribution. So I'll be talking about this experiment just on the assumption that I can think about the electrons in the edge states as an isolated quantum system. And of course, you could argue that that may not be the case. Perhaps these electrons are coupled to phonons or to other degrees of freedom. And the question is what the experimental evidence is against that. And I don't have the data on this slide, but it comes from watching what happens to this electron distribution if you go further down the edge. And it turns out that it doesn't change its form at all if you let it propagate, I think, up to about three times this distance. And it doesn't change, even though if you associate a characteristic temperature with this from the width in energy of the distribution, it's a lot hotter than the bath that the experiment is sitting in. So in other words, there's evidence from the experiment that on the scales that are relevant here, the electrons are decoupled from the other degrees of freedom. Okay, so that's the general background and the background to do with this specific experiment. And now I want to, now I want to switch to theory and first of all, tell you or remind you about the basic theoretical description that we use for this sort of problem. And then according to how much time there is, I'll give you some details of calculations. So first of all, we want a description of the edge states. And of course, to begin with, we have a quantum Hall system with electrons moving in two dimensions. And we really are only interested in motion along the edge. So we want to project from two dimensions down to one. And you can do that in a formal way, but you can also see rather cheaply what form the answer should take. And the point is that at a classical level, the electrons drift around the boundary of the sample with some constant velocity. So if we write down a Hamiltonian that produces that kind of motion, we want something that's linear in the momentum parallel to the edge, because then if we look at Hamilton's equations of motion, we'll find that the drift is with a constant velocity. So if we quantize a Hamiltonian like this, then at the single particle level, we have something linear in the velocity and an electron field here, which I'm taking to be defined just as a function of one coordinate along the edge of the system. Okay, so that's a single particle part of the description, but for interesting things to happen, we also need some interactions in the system. And one way of thinking qualitatively about the effects of interactions is shown schematically in these pictures. So the idea here is that we're looking down from above on the two-dimensional electron system, and the parts that are colored blue are supposed to be regions which are covered with quantum Hall fluid, and the parts which are white are the space outside the sample. And I'm imagining that at time zero, we create some kind of disturbance. We add an electron to the edge of the system. And then we ask how it propagates, how things evolve in time. So if we had no interactions, then everything moves along the edge with some unique velocity. And so this disturbance would just change its position as a function of time. But if we have interactions between the electrons, then one way of thinking about it is to say that when we make a disturbance like this, of course, it generates an electric field. And then, because we're dealing with a quantum Hall system, this electric field will make Hall currents flow. And so perhaps some charge will flow into the bulk behind the excitation and flow out of the bulk in front of the excitation. In other words, as it propagates, the shape of this disturbance will change. Well, of course, that's something that's familiar in many contexts. If a wave packet's shape changes as it propagates, that's because the modes that it's made out of have some dispersion. And in fact, the effect of interactions we can capture by thinking about dispersion in the collective modes of the system. So if we go to a formal description of the problem, then the Hamiltonian involves a single body term, which is linear in the momentum. And the obvious kind of interaction to write down is some sort of interaction between densities at different points along the edge with some interaction potential U. And we can go from this description in terms of electrons to a description in terms of collective modes using the machinery of bosonization. And for the moment, let me just talk about the results. And the nice thing about that approach is that when you discuss the problem in terms of collective modes, you come down to a quadratic Hamiltonian for those collective modes. And everything about the system is encoded in the way that the frequency depends on wave vector. So if we had a non-interacting system, then the frequency would just be linear in wave vector with the velocity of the edge electrons as the velocity for the collective modes. But when you include interactions in the system, then they feed through and influence the dispersion relation of the collective modes. And in point of fact, it's the Fourier transform of this interaction potential which appears in the dispersion relation for the collective modes. So I talked really implicitly there about an edge state at filling factor one, where we just have a single channel. But a particularly simple case to think about is actually at filling factor two, where if we consider this picture of states as a function of energy and as a function of distance from the edge of the sample, we have two Landau levels which are occupied in the bulk and which pass through the chemical potential at the boundary of the sample. And so we have two modes that can carry charge around the perimeter of the sample. And the simplest kind of interaction to consider here is just a contact interaction. And it turns out that in that case, the eigenmodes of the system involve not charge on one edge or charge on the other, but rather symmetric or anti-symmetric combinations of charge added to the two. So the symmetric combination travels with a higher velocity and the anti-symmetric one with a lower velocity, and the split in the velocities is proportional to the strength of the interaction. And this is something which was pointed out, I guess, about 25 years ago, perhaps longer, by Xiaogang Wen. And it's actually one of the simplest examples of fractionalization. So what it means, for example, is that if you add an electron to one of these two edges at time zero and ask for the probability for it to arrive at some point further down the edge at some later time, then the electron that you add breaks up into two packets which travel separately with these two velocities. So the probability for the electron that you added to be found at some later time will be concentrated around two points which are displaced with the corresponding velocities.
What do you mean by contact interaction? What is that?
Oh, I mean a local interaction. So, I mean, so when I just talked about one mode, I had an interaction like that, and now I've got a label and I want to make this just a delta function. If I did that in the single channel case, there would be nothing interesting. I mean, firstly, because of Pauli exclusion, meaning that the electrons are never in the same place, and also because if you put a delta function interaction here, then the Fourier transform obviously is just a constant, and so what it does is simply shift the edge velocity, but you get the physics of non-interacting electrons in the sense that you have a linear dispersion for the collective modes. But if we go to the two-channel case, then even with linear dispersion for the collective modes, because we have two branches, we can have something interesting happening. Okay, so now I want to use that description of edge states and talk about doing some theory for this experiment. There's a difficulty when you come to try and make the details of the theory work, and it's that there's a conflict between two different ways that you might try and describe the system. So you certainly want to be able to deal with interactions, and they're handled most simply if you use bosonization and go to these collective modes. But on the other hand, you also need to be able to describe the tunneling at the quantum point contact, because that's what produces the non-equilibrium distribution. And that's very simple in fermionic description, because the tunneling is just bilinear in the fermion operators, of course. But if you bosonize, then you get, in fact, a cosine of the boson field, so it becomes thoroughly nonlinear. And there's been some previous work on the experiments using various different approaches, a Boltzmann equation and something phenomenological where you think of the point contact as being represented by a source of noise. But I think there are some fundamental questions which the experiments raise, which is maybe difficult to think about cleanly if you make approximations. And so I want to describe some alternative approaches. So the first one will be to put the details of the experiment on one side and think about a quantum quench. And the second approach is actually an exact solution for a specific problem, but one that is quite close to the actual experiment, I think. So this first approach, thinking about a different problem, but one that I claim is related to the experiment, really builds on the idea that this experiment has things in common with, for example, experiments in cold atoms. And there's a class of experimental problem and theoretical problem, which goes under the name of quantum quenches, where you think of initializing the system in some simple state, which is not just the ground state or even an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian, and then you ask how it evolves as a function of time. So to try and say something about these experiments, the idea is that we should choose an initial state for a translationally invariant quantum Hall edge, which has the kind of electron distribution that we expect the tunneling at the point contact to generate just immediately downstream from the point contact. But instead of really trying to model the point contact using a Hamiltonian, instead we'll take our initial state to be of this form. And then we'll ask how that wave function evolves in time. So you can get a kind of intuitive picture of what you might expect to happen if you think of this initial state as being made up firstly of a filled Fermi C and then some quasi-particles on top. And at least pictorially, you can think of these quasi-particles in the initial state as being made up of a sequence of wave packets, and their separation will be inversely proportional to the voltage. In other words, inversely proportional to the width of this step. And then within the framework of this kind of picture, what you imagine as time goes by is that these wave packets will spread because of the dispersion in the collective modes. And at least the time scale for equilibration will be the time scale for the spreading of the wave packet to become comparable to the initial separation. So you can run that in a bit more detail, for example, in the case of two edge modes with short range interactions, which gave us these two velocities for the in phase and out of phase excitations of the charge density. So we'll have an initial quasi-particle separation, which goes inversely with the applied voltage. And wave packets will spread in time in this simple case where we've got two velocities, just proportionally to time with the difference in the two velocities as the coefficient. And so if we ask for the time scale when the spreading is comparable to the initial separation, we come down to an expression like this. And so there are a couple points to make. Firstly, the equilibration time gets shorter and shorter the larger the initial voltage. In other words, the further out of equilibrium the initial state is. And secondly, the equilibration time goes like 1 over the difference between these two velocities. But the difference in the velocities was controlled by the strength of interactions. So you see that if we take the interaction strength to 0, then the equilibration time diverges, which is, of course, reasonable.
Why do you call it equilibration?
Right, okay. So that was the next thing that I wanted to discuss. So maybe a better word to have used at this stage would have been relaxation time, because you can imagine, and I'll go on to discuss in a moment, that at times much longer than this scale, the electron distribution reaches some limiting form. But at the same time, you might be very suspicious about whether it'll be a thermal equilibrium form, precisely because in this system, we have an example of an integrable problem, and because the Hamiltonian, when we write it in terms of collective modes, is simply a harmonic Hamiltonian, the energy separately in each of the collective modes is a conserved quantity, and so you probably don't expect thermal equilibrium.
But why has it even reached a steady state? I mean, in your picture is that the white packets are just spreading, but
further
in directions that are not.
Well, they're spreading, but somehow once each wave packet gets much wider than the separation between successive ones, there's not very much that can happen. I mean, it might be that if you probed higher and higher order correlation functions at longer and longer times, you'd be able to detect something that was evolving. But if you just look at a two-point correlation function, for example, it does approach a limiting form on this time scale.
I guess the other way of asking the same question is, why the behavior is not quasi-periodic? So if we say period set by whatever the difference, inverse the difference of velocities. I mean, effectively you have non-interacting systems, right? So you have two non-interacting states. And what you're saying is that you have to wait certain time and then there will be an overlap.
Yeah,
but if I wait a little bit longer, then they will again separate.
I mean, I think the basic reason is that there's a whole continuum of frequencies in the problem right down to zero. So the recurrence time has gone to infinity
but
with the thermodynamic limit.
Every Q level is non-interacting.
Yes.
For a fixed Q, you don't. I guess that's what I'm
confused. So for a given Q, then it's quasi-periodic, but the periods vary continuously.
Saying, right, I guess you're saying that because you have a continuum range of Q.
Yeah. Okay, so then in the rest of the talk, I want to say a little bit about calculations, but I guess...
Well, one more, just to harp on this a little bit.
Yes, sure.
This is something like working with a Vlasov equation rather than a Boltzmann equation. But I mean, everything is, let's keep stressing, is non-interacting and linear. So the appearance of relaxation is, to a certain extent, an illusion. Right?
Yes.
It's not...
Yes.
Whether or not it's thermal, it's still illusory in a certain sense.
Yeah, it is. I think it's a question of what the important observables are.
But do you imagine in the real system there are further things happening that makes it genuinely, so to speak, relaxed?
Well, I'm sure that if you go far enough from the point contact, then things like coupling to other degrees of freedom are important.
Higher order terms in the self-interaction of the electrons.
There are things, but I think probably what's being observed in the experiment, quite a lot of it can be understood at this level.
It's fair to say that there's some characteristic time scale after which system looks are gone, right?
Ergodic. I mean, within this description and it's the energy in each of these modes is conserved. So you wouldn't want to claim that it was ergodic. It's more that some observables reach steady forms. So I realize that I've got maybe five more minutes. I've got far too much detail on the slides. I'll try and go through the remaining slides quite quickly and pick out the points that are interesting, and then maybe if you want some more detail on specific aspects, we can talk about those with the questions. First of all, I want to quickly say a little bit more about this toy problem of a quantum quench. And so the point is that you can do some genuine calculations to back up some of what I've been saying. So you want to specify what observable you're thinking about, and the simplest thing is this two-point correlator of the electrons as a function of time evolving from the initial state. So if you were in the thermal state, this would decay exponentially as a function of separation, with the length scale for the decay set by temperature and the edge velocity. So we can do calculations here basically by switching backwards and forwards between the fermionic and the bosonic description. So the point is, we want to set up an initial state with a double step distribution as a function of energy, and that's defined in terms of fermions. But then we want to do the time evolution, and that's simple if we're talking about bosons. But then the relevant observables are ones that are defined in terms of the fermion fields, and by switching backwards and forwards, we can go through these calculations. So I won't talk about the calculations, but if you look at the result, then you find that at long times you do have a steady form for this two-point correlator, and the short distance part of it is the same as you would have in a thermal state with the same energy density as in the initial state. So that's the kind of behavior that you'd imagine happening if you had some more generic problem without all these conservation laws. But the long distance part of the correlation function, although it decays exponentially as a function of distance, as in a thermal state, it has a decay rate that's not fixed by the energy density and that depends on details of the initial state. So you can ask how big the deviations are in this steady state from a thermal distribution. And if we take an initial state that has this two-step form, then, well, the width of the step in energy or momentum is really just a scale factor. So the only parameter is the height of this step, P, the tunneling probability. And if you look at the difference in the occupation number from a thermal state as a function of momentum, then you see deviations, but actually they're only on the scale of a few percent, a couple of percent, and the detailed form depends on this parameter P. So you get relaxation to a steady state, which is certainly not a thermal distribution, but unfortunately, if an experimentalist wants to try and detect those differences, they're rather small, at least in this observable. Okay, so the other theoretical approach which I wanted to talk about is instead of studying this toy problem with a quantum quench, it involves actually trying to do an honest calculation for a model of the experimental system. As I said, the difficulty is that on the one hand, you'd like to use bosonization to treat the interactions, but on the other hand, the tunneling is simplest in fermionic language. And it turns out that you can do some nonlinear transformations which take the interacting problem into a non-interacting fermion problem. And I think I won't try and describe the details of that. You bosonize and you combine the bosonic modes in new linear combinations, and then you go back to some new fermions. But the upshot of it is that in terms of the new fermions, you have a quadratic Hamiltonian with these new fermions propagating the velocities of the fast and slow modes. But because of these nonlinear transformations, the tunneling is also quadratic in terms of the fermions. And the price that you pay is that the observables you're interested in become more complicated quantities. They basically become exponentials of operators which count the number of fermions within certain intervals on this edge. But because now everything is in terms of free fermions, you can actually evaluate these quantities numerically rather easily by studying fermion determinants. So when you do that, you get two results, really. One is that if you go a long way downstream from the point contact, you get the results that you might have anticipated from this toy problem of a quantum quench. In other words, the things that I was telling you about earlier about this non-thermal distribution hold. Then to compare in detail with the experiment, you can do numerical evaluations, and these are the results that I want to finish on. So I didn't stress this when I described the experiment, but there are actually two types of measurements that you can make. So because the experiment is at filling factor 2, we've got these two channels, and only the innermost channels are coupled by tunneling. So you can measure the electron distribution either in the channel that was coupled by tunneling or in the other channel. So if you measure the distribution in the channel that's coupled by tunneling, then you see what I described at first in this derivative of the occupation as a function of energy. You see two downward going spikes close to the point contact, evolving into one broader one far from the point contact as the two-step distribution broadens into a single-step distribution. And on the other hand, if you make your measurement in the other channel, then the coupling is just by interactions. And so what happens is that you set up a non-equilibrium electron distribution in the other channel, and then it transfers energy to the channel in which you're making the measurement. So as you go from close to the point contact to far from the point contact, the width of the electron distribution increases. And the basic point is that you can fit all these experimental results using essentially one parameter, which is the strength of the interactions. Okay, so I'll finish there. So I mean, I described this toy problem of a quantum quench, which I think tells you quite a lot about the experiment, and I gave you a solution to the full problem, which I think matches reasonably well what's observed. Okay, thank you very much.
Questions?
The solution to the full problem you did was for that?
That's right, for that contact interaction.
Contact
interaction? Yes. With two channels.
With two channels.
Yeah.
That's why there's only one parameter.
That's right.
Otherwise,
exactly.
You would have the whole.
Exactly. Yes. Yes. It would take some completely different approach to deal with a more general case.
So the claim is experimentally it's fed well by a contact.
Yeah.
Would that be expected?
Well, I mean, of course, what you start with fundamentally are Coulomb interactions, but the way that you would describe deviations is by discussing what the form is of the dispersion relation for the collective modes and. So I guess what's crucial is that you have linear dispersion characterized by these two velocities in the energy interval that's relevant for these experiments. So I mean, it might be that if you go to low energies, which would mean longer distances and so on, that this would break down. I mean, whether it's expected or not is probably hard to say because it's hard to think of experiments that really probe this kind of thing in so much detail previously.
I mean, would you have thought that a contact interaction was No, I guess that's the question.
Well, it can't be the whole story, but yeah, I guess it's reasonable that it should be there.
Or another way of asking, would you have said that if you put more or less anything, you'd get a similar result? Because you're basically just looking at the dispersion, modified dispersion relation. Or should we take this as evidence that it really is something like a contact interaction?
Well, I think there would be one interesting experiment, which, as far as I can see, should be possible, but hasn't been done or hasn't been described anyway. And that would be to repeat the experiments for filling factor one. Because for filling factor one, if you simply have a contact interaction, nothing can happen. So anything which you observe happening at filling factor one has got to be evidence of something more than just a contact interaction.
So this is a kind of prediction that nothing would happen if you take this seriously in this model. I'm just repeating, trying to just repeat what you just said.
Yeah, I think you see more generally. You discuss the dispersion relation of the collective mode. So at this level of treatment, you just have linear dispersion. But probably, if you do a more serious treatment of Coulomb interactions, say, then there'd be some curvature, which would be most important probably at long wavelengths. So, it could be that the energy window that's being probed in this experiment is somewhere up here, where it's a decent approximation to say that you have two linear bits to the dispersion, and that if you went to lower energies, you'd begin to see deviation.
More questions? Let's have John in.